Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We keep trucking along through this 60-game season. And every day I feel a little more optimistic we're going to make it. I'm Scott Pianowski, your host. And when I need a calibration check, when I need a reality check, when I need to figure out where baseball is at, I usually send the bat signal out to Fred Zinke, who has been a colleague at Yahoo for a while and has obviously written for a bunch of other sites and, you know, basically dominates fantasy leagues. He's our friend from Canada. Hello, Mr. Zinke.
Hey, Scott. I don't know about dominate fantasy leagues, but I've had some things go my way. And yeah, we were just talking before we started recording that we're both starting to feel a little bit optimistic about this season for once.
Yeah, but let's start with that. I know the Cardinals are in a holding pattern right now, didn't play at all last week, and it sounds like their first series of this week is going to get scrubbed. So I'm not sure. And we know, look, the baseball season's fluid. Everybody knows we're taping this Monday afternoon, but everybody knows that things can change by the hour in baseball or in sports or in life in 2020. That's just kind of the playbook they've handed us. But yeah, a few weeks ago, I was worried that this season was day by day, and I was worried that maybe the boom could be coming. And let's make one thing clear: there are some people on Twitter who seem to have this crazy idea that, like, sports writers want things to not be played. That what sports writers would like nothing more is for devastation and for cancellation and for us to all live a life without sports. That's not me. That's not anybody I know. I would love it. I certainly don't think it's realistic to ask players to be put in unusual health compromising situations. I'm not calling for that, but nothing would make me happier than if they could navigate what would be close to a 60-game season. It sounds like, look, maybe some teams won't get to 60. I'm not sure how they can make up all these Cardinal games. Obviously, it's been a challenge with the Marlins, but let's just start here. I mean, I'm more optimistic that they've done a pretty good job with this. And I know it's very trendy to also bash baseball for a number of things. And I'm not saying that they've done a wonderful job with this. It's uncharted territory. I don't remember any other sports years that tried to dealt with a pandemic, not in my lifetime. So let's start with the good news. They have gotten to this point where most of the games are getting played. And, you know, there's been some odd things. You know, some guys are hitting, some guys aren't. Some guys are pitching, some guys aren't. But I think it's a win that we've actually had as much baseball played as we have.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. You know, you almost don't notice the absence of the Cardinals because there's so many games going on still every day. I mean, I noticed when the Phillies weren't playing and the Marlins weren't playing and the Cardinals weren't playing and everything. But now with just the Cardinals not playing, it feels pretty normal. I'm kind of optimistic that they'll get every team to 60 games, that the 7-inning doubleheaders, I think was a major move by them. And, like, purists aren't going to like it, but you know what? This just isn't the season for the purists. Like, if you want 162 games and 9 innings in every game and regular extra innings, this just isn't for you. And it's not for you in every sport, the NBA, the NHL, whatever. They're all different. So the 7-inning doubleheaders, I think, is a game changer. They might be able to get the Cardinals to 60 games either by just loading them up with doubleheaders like they did with the Marlins, or doing a combination of that and maybe tacking a couple days onto the end of the regular season, maybe where the Cardinals play 4 games in 2 days if they need to just finish it out. But I'm kind of confident they can get every team to 60 games right now. We're even seeing a lot of teams this week with five game weeks. So teams are getting a bit of rest too. Even the Marlins have a 5-game week this week to kind of catch their breath and get ready for a bunch of doubleheaders coming up.
Now, it used to be when I saw teams with doubleheaders on my Yahoo schedule, I would just lean into them, especially if it was a player I thought would play both games. But now with the 7-inning doubleheaders, it can be really tricky. Like, I have Luke Voit in the league. The Yankees had a recent doubleheader. Voit wasn't starting the first game. And so I had to kind of guess. I had some other alternatives. I think maybe Mitch Moreland was on one of those teams, and I hope I went with Moreland. I can't remember what I did. But the point is, I knew Voit wasn't going to start both games. And even if he started the second game, you're thinking, well, that's a 7-inning game. Maybe he'll pinch hit in the first game. How has the doubleheader rule of the 7 innings? I'm curious if you like that rule and if it has changed fantasy playability for you at all.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't love the rule, but I understand why they did it. I thought maybe they could have left it at 9 innings and left the rosters at 30 so that teams would have the pitching, couple extra pitchers if they needed them to to cover the extra innings in those games. But because my first thought is always fantasy, I never think too much about the why behind the rules or whether I like them. I just figure out how to manage them for fantasy. And I still steer into the doubleheader players a little bit. I think the short, if we were 162 games and they had these doubleheaders, you're really likely to sit a lot of your players. A Luke Voit, it makes sense to maybe sit one of the games in the doubleheaders, but the real stars of the teams, if they can go twice in the doubleheaders, I think the teams will want them to, especially if the teams feel like they're competing. And the expanded playoffs makes a lot of teams feel like they're competing. When the Marlins play a lot of doubleheaders coming up, their roster is so shallow now that I think VR, Aguilar, some players like that, I think they're going to play, especially when it's seven innings. I think they're going to play, and when you have a DH available, I think they're going to play both games of the doubleheader. I mean, to play 14 innings with a bit of a break in between the two games, it's not that taxing for a player who's in like pretty good shape and is only playing 60 games this season in the first place. So I still lean into them a little bit. Where I steer away from them a little bit is maybe with some middle relievers, because if a team has a bunch of doubleheaders in a week, seven inning games, you may not need to use that. You may not need to use a Drew Pomeranz, right? In either of the games. If your starter can go six, you can go starter closer. And if you're not going to your closer, it's a good chance the game's out of hand or you're losing anyway. So that's the one position that I don't want to see the doubleheaders.
It's funny you mentioned middle relievers. That's one of the things I wanted to talk about today. It used to be, look, you wanted as many good starters as you could, and you wanted some closers, obviously, because they get saves. And you would think about the middle relievers. Okay, if they have good ratios, maybe they'll help my ERA. Maybe they'll help my whip. They might pick up the occasional win. So those guys could have value depending on your format. There'd be other formats they might not have as much value. But now I look at a guy like Joaquin Soria, who good team, big park. He's got a nice, really nice strikeout rate. He struck out 13 in 7.2 innings. We'll get the occasional win. We'll get the occasional save. Now, a lot of times it takes some time to figure out what pitchers we can trust. And man, in this season, there's been a bunch of pitchers I thought I could trust who aren't pitching well. There's been guys I didn't think that much of who are pitching great. But it's been a while since, in a mixed league, especially the friends and family league, you can churn guys every game. We do have a transaction cap, so you can't just do it like crazy every day. But I feel like I've never been as interested in non-closing relievers or middle relievers as I am this year. I mean, so many starters won't even go five innings. Sometimes if you get that first reliever into a game, he may be inheriting a six-run lead. Like I think Chad Green did over the weekend, where Cole didn't go deep enough to qualify for the win. They basically handed Green a win just by getting on the mound. So has your viewpoint or valuation of the middle reliever changed in this unusual season?
Well, I think my viewpoint maybe of the back end starters has changed a little bit this season, and then therefore you got to trend somewhere else. So, any starter who I don't think is going to throw five innings, or where I think maybe there's even like a 50% chance that he's not going to throw the five innings, he's kind of off my list to put in my lineup, especially in a weekly transaction league. So, when you take those starters out, that's a lot of starters out. There's not a lot left, and then that makes the middle relievers more appealing because I need someone to fill that spot. So, I have some shares of James Karinchak, for example. I have some Soria. I have some Drew Pomeranz. Those guys, they're just not going to hurt me. And in the span of a week, they're going to get me the 3 to 4 strikeouts. Maybe I am looking for the guys like the Chad Greens who can maybe get the vulture win in a week. But the one thing that's been tricky, I find, this year with middle relievers, I don't know if you found this with your teams too or not, but the closer turnover has been so great that I find we're chasing the next possible save source all the time. You and I have talked more than once before about how great liberating it is to just stop chasing saves. But if you are chasing saves, there's so many relievers to chase in that potential saves battle, and you can only have room for so many on your roster that sometimes it's hard to find room for someone like a Soria or a Pomeranz if you feel like they have a zero chance or close to a zero chance of getting saves. I know they both have saves this year, but if you think going forward, they don't. It's like we're always chasing the next Angels guy or Astros or Rangers. There's just so many. I counted once, at one point about a week ago, I counted half the league where the closer situation was in some level of flux.
Yeah, you know, I think when it comes to saves, and I'm going to tie in steals here, I think it's become oddly comforting for me in both categories because the striation is so real with the saves. The more guys than ever are getting saves. And with stolen bases, there's just not – so many teams just don't want to run as a general rule of thumb. There's just, it's not in their playbook. And we've identified a few teams that do want to run. The Padres seem like they want to run. The Mariners want to run, which I don't think is uncommon. A lot of times just bad teams just say, screw it. What else do we have going for us? Just run as much as we can. And so what I've started to do, I felt any good fantasy owner needs to kind of evaluate every save. When an odd save comes around, you have to ask, okay, was the regular closer not available that day? Was this one of those kind of like sneaky three-inning saves that you don't put any stock into? I feel like we've all been detectives of the save, you know, for as long as fantasy has been going on because it's so important. I almost feel like we have to be detectives of the stolen base now. God forbid anybody steals two in a game. I think you have to ask yourself, what's going on here? Is J.P. Crawford for real? He just had a two-steal game? Or look at the teams that seem open to running. Again, I mentioned the Mariners and the Padres. There are a handful of others. Conversely, there are some teams that have like one or two stolen bases. So one, I think my approach has changed for stolen bases. Every stolen base I feel like deserves the CSI treatment on some level. But because we need fewer of each stat to be competitive, I oddly find it liberating and not stressful. We talked about that with the saves. I'm kind of at that with the stolen bases as well. Has your approach, has your emotions, has your equilibrium on the stolen base chase, has that changed at all in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, steals are like gold right now. Like, it's almost the first thing I check in the box score is to see if I get, before I check to see if I got a home run. And a home run helps you in four categories. You know, it's a hit, an RBI, a run scored, and a home run.
Right.
I check for a steal first, and then I check to see. It's really changed dramatically. I still put a fair amount of focus in competing in the steals category because I want to compete in all five offensive categories. I'm more likely to – I didn't do enough saves punting this year. I wish I had actually done more of it. I think that it's easy to punt saves. You just don't grab guys who for the reason of saves. If you happen to – just accidentally own Rafael Montero because you liked him as a good reliever who had a great strikeout to walk rate last year, then you can have him. But I mean, you don't pick him because he might get saves. If he happens to get saves, you grab some saves. With the steals, I am still chasing the steals. Sometimes I wonder if steals needs to go as a fantasy category. I think the league's dismissed it so much that, like you said, we're almost chasing Padres and Mariners, just whatever. We're chasing managers at this point rather than players. Sometimes I wonder if steals needs to go. I've been a bit of a proponent of saves plus holds. I still think that may, now that relievers have to face three batters, that maybe saves plus holds needs to become more of a norm. And then we would go back to chasing skills in relievers a little more than just ninth inning opportunity. Steals, I wonder if that category at some point will need to go just because it's such a mess. And just because it's been so devalued by the league itself.
I'm looking at the steals leaderboard right now. Tommy Pham leads the majors with five. And again, we mentioned the running Padres. A handful of guys with four. And there's two names that are right next to each other. And there's one guy that makes me really happy and one guy that kind of makes me a little bit sad. Fernando Tatis Jr. makes me sad only because I don't have any of him. Right now, he's hitting .333, 15 runs scored, 8 home runs, 18 RBIs. Those would that would be enough to make him a monster as it is, but he's also stolen 4 bases. It's not that I didn't like Tatis. I mean, you go into a draft, the other 11 teams get the draft players too. I just didn't fall into him. I think part of it may have been because I thought shortstop was so deep that I didn't have to prioritize it early. But it wasn't like I had anything against Tatis. I just don't have him on any teams. Now, a player I do have on a lot of my teams, and this guy hasn't been anywhere near as valuable, although he does check in as a top 100 player right now, is Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. I liked him. He was one of those when the windows opened up on pickups in July, right before the season started. I got it on him because he had a catcher eligibility, but he probably wasn't going to catch. Now, he doesn't have great run production numbers right now. He only has 2 RBIs, but he is hitting .333. He's playing most of the time, and he's stolen 4 bases. So I realize these are of different scales. If you have Tatis right now, there's a good chance you're near the – he's probably, I'm going to guess, the player who's on the most productive Yahoo fantasy rosters right now, where, you know, Connor Falefa is more one of those guys. Oh, okay, I have a catcher who's being productive, which is nice. But are you in on Tatis this year? Do you get the idea? I feel like he could be like the magazine cover boy next year. Like maybe he'll be the National League MVP. And then next year people will be like, is Tatis the number one pick? I feel like this could be as short as it is of a season, maybe a season that just throws him into the national consciousness. So I'm curious what you think of him. And it's always hard to find quality catchers. And what's more fun in fantasy than a catcher who really isn't a catcher? So I know these are two different types of players, but any feelings on Tatis or Connor Falefa?
Yeah, I have a fair amount of Tatis on my teams. And he fit the profile of what I was looking for in the early rounds with that power speed mix. I wasn't totally sure that the batting average was repeatable. So far it is. We'll see. He's just so young and he's actually making improvements as we go. I do think it's time to already time to open our minds to the thought that he could be next year's Ronald Acuna, like next year's guy who goes first overall at such a young age, because he just, you know, Acuna was threatening 40-40 last year. If this was a 162 game season, we would be talking about Tatis in those kinds of terms. So I think if Tatis hits 300 this year, if he's among the leaders in steals and home runs, at his age, what was the stat? 30 homers and 20 steals in his first 100 major league games. Like that is a
right.
That is going to be that's a number. Those are numbers that are going to stick in my head. And I think a 318 or something batting average in those first 100 games. Like though, I know he's been a little BABIP fortunate, but you start watching him crush the ball and you realize like maybe he's someone who's going to carry a high BABIP through his 20s. Like, well, he's such a fast runner and hits the ball hard. So, I think he'll be a first rounder next year easily and could be a tie of the number one pick. With Connor Falefa, I actually agree. The one thing I really agree that you kind of hit on late when you're talking about him is getting the catchers who don't play catcher. You know, it keeps them in the lineup more often. It's probably a little better for them physically, allows them maybe to concentrate on their hitting a little more since they don't have to worry about calling the game, you know, working behind the plate. I don't have any shares. Everybody was really interested and I kind of just put in competitive bids on him everywhere. But I think he's the kind of smart addition you can get as your second, especially in the two catcher leagues, as your second catcher. Austin Nola is another guy like that with the Mariners where, you know, he's benefited from Tom Murphy being on the IL, but Nola is another guy who's catcher eligible, but can play other positions as well.
I did an article last week as one of the closing times. And by the way, you've been doing a great job. You've been a wonderful addition to our closing time rotation, where you get the take, basically the last 24 hours of fantasy baseball. I write that a couple of times. Fred writes it a couple of times. Dalton Del Don writes it as well. And I looked last week and I saw, 230 batting average in baseball. That sounds pretty low. Well, actually, we're on pace to have the lowest batting average in baseball history. And I know this whole season's going to go down with some kind of asterisk, real or imagined, but I found it interesting that even in a year when they got rid of the DH, so we no more of these pitchers up there taking these terrible swings and they're all hitting 130 and everything, you know, with a few exceptions, they're still hitting 230. And the strikeout rate is also the highest it's ever been. It's the lowest doubles rate in like 40 years. It's the lowest triples rate of all time. So I was trying to think, well, what could a fantasy owner do? How can we adjust to this if this is real? And we know some of these trends are very real. The strikeout rate has been going up for several years. Home runs were down a little bit, but it was still one of the highest home run rates in history. So I started to think, well, what players get the ball in play? And maybe there's something to be mined there. And I looked at the contact leaderboard, and I saw people like David Fletcher, who was at the time first. I think he's second now in contact rate. He plays a bunch of different positions for the Angels. Decent production numbers, and he's actually got some I think double-digit home runs and stolen bases. I'm always interested in a guy like that. JP Crawford, he hasn't done much the last few days, but I thought of a post-type sleeper. He had a first-round pedigree. He's batting leadoff now. He's willing to steal bases. And somebody further down the list, this really surprised me because I haven't really thought about Kyle Seager for many years. I always thought, okay, he's got a little power, doesn't hit for much of an average, but he's always had a reasonable contact rate. And this year in particular, he's bumped it up. He's swinging at fewer pitches out of the strike zone than he ever has before. So I just wonder if he's improved some approach. I made a joke that maybe they were banging trash cans in Seattle and, you know, nobody knew about it. But what do you think about contact rate as being one of the leading indicators that we can find some unheralded fantasy guys. Because again, you know, I don't think a lot of people thought much of Fletcher going into the season. It seems like Madden really loves him. JP Crawford was available probably in just about every league before the season. And I think maybe I misjudged Kyle Seager. I know we're talking about real small amounts of data. It's only been a few weeks. Curiously enough, Kiner Falefa also shows up on that list. He's a top 25 guy in contact rate. Do you think we need to be evaluating what that stat means for fantasy?
I think so. I'll give you another name, is Hanser Alberto. I don't know where he's on the list for this year, but I know traditionally in his career, he's a, you know, not a great counting stat guy, but a high contact rate, hits for high average, and he hit 300 last year. He's hitting 300 this year. I grabbed him in our labor league actually for $10 out of 100, so 10% of my budget, which I thought was pretty reasonable. The batting average is interesting. It's almost like our steals discussion where, you know, a 10 steals over 162 games player is now quite valuable because your team's getting so few steals. And same with batting average. A roster of 240 hitters 10 years ago would have left you last in batting average. Right now, a roster of 240 hitters, and you'd be thinking like, oh, I'm pretty good. I'm a little bit above average, or about around average, maybe in my fantasy league in batting average. Something that I think when you talk about contact rate, and I think we're going to have to have the dust settle on this season before we evaluate it, but something that I haven't heard discussed maybe enough in the fantasy industry, but I have heard it discussed in amongst major league players, because of the Astros scandal, they're giving players less video to use during the games. Right. You know, that was one of the trickle down effects from that. And some players, we've seen some teams and players complain about it. I know the Rays complained about it a few days ago, saying they feel like everyone's being punished for what the Astros did. No point really as fantasy managers to get into why they're doing it and if they should do it. The bottom line is they're doing it. Some players are going to be more heavily impacted by that change than others. And there's some players who are saying, you know, I really feel, you know, less comfortable at the plate, especially in my second or third at bat against the starting pitcher than I used to. Now, these guys, before we get too into their complaining, you know, they all got to the majors without the use of in-game video. So, I mean, they were performing at high levels in the minors, in college, whatever, in high school without the in-game video. But the bottom line is some of them have been using this in-game video the last few years in the majors, find it really helpful. I think it's more responsible for the batting average dip than people are letting on. And I will be watching in the off season to see if that policy continues to 2021, because if it does, I will put more credibility into looking for players whose contact rate changed a lot from 2019 to 2020, especially veterans, because that may be a sign that the lack of video use, you know, really impacted that player. And if he's still not allowed to use it in 2021, I need to factor that in. It's almost like how we were a little slow to adjust to the shifts. And then eventually we were like, hey, these shifts aren't going away. If they're ruining, you know, a certain player's batting average, like they're going to continue to do that next year. So the video, I think, like I said, I think we haven't really gotten our head around it. There's just so many stories right now with COVID and the league just trying to function. But I could see that being a good off-season discussion topic.
Yeah, JD Martinez is another player off to a slow start. And mm-hmm. the lack of video in-game has been mentioned as a possible explanation for that. You know, it's fun. Again, we're dealing with tiny samples, and I'm not sure that a lot of these things wouldn't be ironed out in a full season. But before the year, I thought Baltimore was going to be awful. I thought the Marlins were going to be a joke. Obviously, Miami's had a very strange season because they didn't play for such a long time. But, I mean, when they've been on the field, they played pretty well. And I look at this Baltimore lineup. We mentioned Alberto a second ago. Right now, Renato Nunez, Hanser Alberto, and Anthony Santander are all top 50 commodities in Yahoo Fantasy. And in a lot of leagues, you probably just could have picked these guys up for nothing. Nunez and Alberto qualify at multiple positions. With Santander, I think he was productive last year, and then it was a question of how healthy he was at the beginning of the season. I might have been open to drafting him maybe in different set of circumstances this year. I had no expectations for Nuno and Alberto. I've actually added Nunez in the Friends and Family League for the two positions. And you know, it's funny, Fred, we always love ability in fantasy baseball, but I feel like availability has never been more important. Just getting a team on the field, collecting the at-bats, knowing what team is affected by the schedule that week. If you're in a game where it has daily transactions, just making sure you have that lineup adjusted before they get on the field. We always know that getting a lot of at-bats in a mixed league is usually an advantage. Has your opinion as your of the Orioles change? Do you see anything exciting going on in Miami? I think we always have to be open that, look, we know like there's talent on the Dodgers and the Astros and the Yankees, but I feel like if you could win the race to the talented guy on the Orioles or on the Pirates or on the Marlins or on the Tigers or whoever it is, you know, even if these teams don't ultimately prove to be contenders by the end of the year, there's going to be fantasy value in every city to varying lengths. I'm open to admit that maybe I didn't see the possibility of the Orioles until just recently.
Yeah, I think the Orioles are a good cautionary tale. I mean, we'll see where they go from here, but maybe, you know, to really consider players on all 30 teams. I mean, we always do, but, you know, to be a little more, for us all to be a little more open-minded to Orioles and Marlins and Pirates and Royals and things like that, you know, on draft day. I have a fair amount of Santander on my teams. I also have a lot of Austin Hayes, who's not off to a good start, but he plays a lot, and I still think there's some potential there. Like you said, the availability, like getting players or just in their team's lineup, especially players who are in the top half or in the heart of their team's lineup every game. And the Orioles aren't going to score like the Dodgers. But, you know, if Nunez is in the lineup every day hitting in the top half, you know, he can give you plenty of counting stats for such a cheap investment cost. So I think that it is a good cautionary tale. On the subject of the availability, I wanted to ask you, have you changed how you're managing your benches this year because of COVID? Because I have a little bit. Like, have you swung your benches towards hitters at all this year, just trying to make sure with Cardinals out sometimes and Marlins out and that's out, like, are you trying to just to make sure that you always have active hitters?
Yeah, I have, and not just in Yahoo formats, but I think of things like the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational, where you have the Monday swap and then the Friday swap. And there's nothing worse than, oh, okay, the Cubs aren't playing this weekend. I need to replace Chris Bryant. Oh, I don't have anybody who plays that position. I'm going to take zeros through the weekend. Mm-hmm. I feel like you need to have more options because in those leagues, you can only swap out hitters on Fridays. I think having more pliability with your hitters actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the multi-position hitter that you can put in for, you know, a bunch of possibilities if they end up not having a series on the weekend. Going all the way back to when we were talking about the middle relievers, that's another thing that's made it tough for me to squeeze sometimes a good middle reliever onto my roster is, you know, you're chasing saves with certain relievers, you're trying to hold enough starters to stay up in wins and strikeouts, but also just if my bench has kind of switched where I used to be more like, say if it's a 7-man bench, maybe 4 or 5 pitchers. Now I'm more like 2 or 3 pitchers because I'm holding more hitters on my bench. So I'm holding these kind of blah, but useful hitters. Leury Garcia I have on a few teams. He's multi-position eligible, 3 positions in most formats, and he plays every day. You know, he's on my bench and in and out of my lineup in a lot of formats. He's in my lineup at the expense of a Chad Green or something like that because I find often in the weekly leagues, I'm making sure that on Monday I have my pitchers for the week and then they typically lock anyways. So they're locked. And even in the Yahoo format with the daily format, I'm trying to keep some hitters on my bench. So, I mean, you know, it's a zero sum game as Corey Schwartz always used to say. And if I'm going to have an extra hitter on my bench, it means I'm going to have one less pitcher on my bench.
Yeah, Nico Goodrum of the Tigers, who is off mm-hmm. to a, you know, an ordinary start, but he's another guy. I love those guys who qualify at multiple positions because then it frees you up just to add a lot of times, just add the best player you can because you have the positional coverage all set. I mentioned the Marlins in passing earlier. I want to mention a breakout that I actually think is real because this player's been good before. Jesus Aguilar, just a couple of years ago, had a really great season with Milwaukee and then fell apart the following year. He's bounced around. Seems like he has a job in Miami now, and he's, you know, he's hitting over 300. He's already hit 4 home runs for a team that's played a limited schedule. And I think people have been slow to him in Yahoo again, maybe because, you know, the Marlins weren't playing. And so when a team isn't on the field, you're not going to be picking up their guys. But he's just 12% rostered in Yahoo. I think there's a moment, there's an opportunity here for a lot of people to go grab some Aguilar.
I totally agree. Aguilar is someone who I drafted actually on probably about half of the teams I drafted this year. And I just late rounds, you know, it was just the general theory of he was so effective in 2018. Like, did those skills really totally disappear in 2019 or with full-time playing time? Could they come back? I'm I still have him in some spots, but I'm disappointed to say in some spots, I just couldn't hold him during the Marlins layoff. You know, I needed the roster spot. And then not knowing who were the Marlins who had contracted COVID, but you knew statistically it was about half the team. So there's about a 50% chance if you held Aguilar, you were holding a late round pick who 50% chance he's contracted COVID. And you know for sure his team was sitting out for a while. So I had to let him go in some leagues because I just needed the roster spot to pick up a different first baseman or whatever. So I was kind of disappointed about that. And then obviously he comes back, he hits home runs in fab bidding, he goes for a lot. I feel like I'm stubborn. I don't want to spend triple digits on someone who I dropped the week before and admit the mistake. Right. So I let someone else have him and just cross my fingers. But I think he's a great example of the cheap bounce back. You know, we're always looking at the stars coming off the down seasons, but he's kind of in the middle of his career and he was so cheap. Like you were getting him in around 20 something, even in the 15 team leagues. Sometimes he was a bench player even in a 15 team league. Like, why not take the shot on someone? Just, and it was a 1 year downturn.
You know, one player who I have in the Friends of the Family League, but I don't have anywhere near as much as I wish I did, is Mike Yastrzemski. And I think it's fascinating when players, we talked about this a little bit with Ron Chandler last week. When non-pedigree player, and Yastrzemski obviously has a famous name. His grandfather was Carl Yastrzemski. He was a Hall of Famer, 1967 Triple Crown winner and all that stuff. But you know, Yastrzemski had a nice little season, age 29, but he wasn't a prospect. Team didn't look good. The San Francisco Park generally isn't a great place to hit. Well, what's happened? Yastrzemski looks great. He's hitting home runs. He's walking. He's got a really good walk strikeout rate. He's hitting home runs off lefty pitching. He took Clayton Kershaw deep over the weekend. And it seems like they've made some changes at the San Francisco Park. They've closed some archways. The ball's absolutely flying out of that place. I've seen some right-handed hitters hit balls out of that park to right field. You know, one of them was Tatis on a middle inside slider. Maybe Tatis is just such a special player, he can do that. But I feel like it's worth it to maybe recalibrate that San Francisco Park. I know it goes on a tiny sample, and that's like the rule number one of a stat sample is don't overreact to a small stats sample, but they've made a change to the park and I can see things visually. The announcers can't stop talking about it. I wonder, is there a lesson in Mike Yastrzemski? Is there a takeaway from him? Do you have any Yastrzemski? Do you believe in Yastrzemski? What's your stance on all that?
I have no shares. I wish I did. I have a bit of a belief. I think you might be onto something with the park change. And I think for me, the takeaways with him are, you know, be more open or aware to park changes and how they could potentially impact teams. And I think that Yastrzemski falls right into, you know, something we were just discussing with the Marlins and the Orioles. I mean, the Giants, period, were a group of players that most of us wrote off on draft day and said, I don't want any Giants starting pitchers because they're not going to score any runs. And I don't want any Giants hitters because they're not going to score any runs. And I don't want the Giants closer because they don't really have a closer and they're not going to win any games. And here are the Giants, and you know, the Giants aren't going to win the World Series, but they're not doing as badly as we all expected. And there is a bit of fantasy production. Donovan Solano has had in deep leagues has had some moments. So, you know, I think that's the big thing is when Yastrzemski started. I felt like we were all actually just noticing in the weekly Fab leagues, we're all maybe a week late on him, where he was starting to get onto something early in the season, and you could have picked him up cheap. And then you waited and then in leagues where he hung around the extra week, boom, he was, you know, $150, $200, which is a lot to pay for an outfielder. So I think it's right back to the Orioles and it's right back to the Marlins and the Mariners and JP Crawford. You know, don't be afraid to invest in possible breakout players from the weaker teams because you also know that they don't have a lot of competition for playing time.
You know, for seasons, we've been chasing after pitchers on the Astros staff, and there's a lot of stars at the front of that. You know, Justin Verlander in a healthier day, everybody would want. Garrett Cole would always be somebody we want. Zach Greinke has been probably a borderline Hall of Famer right now. But we've had trouble identifying the non-star. Who are the next guys going to be up? You know, Lance McCullers has had a lot of stops and starts. Josh James has had stops and starts. And I wonder if they finally come up with something with Framber Valdez, who's still available in about 75% of Yahoo leagues. He had an 8-strikeout start against the Angels, and then he pitched at Oakland. It was a tough luck loser, but he struck out 9 in seven innings. This is a guy who's getting a lot of strikeouts. He's worked into the seventh inning in his last two starts, which I mean, you just don't see that all that often. I feel like any pitcher gets to the seventh inning, I want to start throwing a parade for him. He qualifies at both starting pitching and starting pitcher and relief pitcher, which is really valuable in certain leagues in Yahoo, depending on how the structure of your league is. You know, maybe you want to sneak a starter into the relief spot. I know it's only 17 innings, but he's got the 17 strikeouts, 2.04 ERA, 1.08 whip. In one of my weekly bid leagues, I really wanted Valdez. I put out what I thought was a very aggressive bid, and I didn't get him, which was kind of frustrating. We have to act on small samples this year. It's only a 2-month season. There's none of this, I'm going to wait for a month and see what happens. It's, you know, the guy's going to be gone now. I'm just curious where you come down on Framber Valdez.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested. As like you said, the Astros have had a bit of trouble lately with their back end pitching. That being said, it's a really favorable park to pitch in. And the West right now has a lot of favorable parks between the AL and the NL. And we know they'll just stay in the West this season. So, you know, I have some Christian Javier and he got a lot more hype and went for a lot of money. I was okay with that because his minor league numbers are outstanding. And I love grabbing young pitchers who have like were consistently successful in the minors, you know, at every level, every stop, you know, ERAs in the twos, whip around one or less. Valdez has been more up and down, but I agree. I actually ended up getting him for a really low price in an NFBC league last night. I forget what it was, but I'm going to say it was about $20, $20, $25 out of 1,000. And
I hate you for Zinke, man. I bid so much more than that and didn't get him.
I know. And that's it really in the end. Well, this is kind of a fab strategy of mine, but in the end, you just make competitive bids in all your leagues and cross your fingers. There was a league where I would have really liked him and I might have bid 50. And I didn't get him. And I know 50 is not a lot, but I didn't have a lot to spend. So, you know, I think the gap between Valdez and Javier is probably a lot closer than what my fab bidding would indicate and everyone's fab bidding would indicate. But I think things are going way wrong for the Astros right now, but it's still a good park to pitch in. And I wouldn't be surprised. It's still a really talented lineup. Like I wouldn't be surprised if the lineup stays healthy, if certain starting pitchers can end up being, you know, fantasy assets. And maybe that's Javier. Maybe it's Valdez. Maybe it's Brandon Belak, who made his first start last week. Minor league numbers are okay. You know, maybe he can be a back end guy in mixed leagues. But I think there is some chance for some useful pitching there if the lineup can get cooking. And I do think, you know, all the trash can jokes aside, when you have Springer, Altuve, Bregman, Michael Brantley, Yuli Gurriel, etc., Kyle Tucker in your lineup, there is the potential there for your lineup to get hot at some point.
You know, one thing that just kind of frustrates me about the short season, because I thought it was really going to be fun to have a 60-game season other than the reason of why we're doing it. I really hate the idea that they expanded the playoffs as much as they did, because I would love the sense of gravity of teams could start panicking. And we, you know, the Astros wouldn't be guaranteed to be in the playoffs. They got off to a bad start, or the Dodgers or the Yankees, whoever it was. But I feel like some of these more talented teams probably think, okay, look, we just get to beat half the league. We're in the playoffs. Let's take that time to get our players where they want, to get our pitchers in a good position of health. And I think it would have been a lot more fun to watch the gravity of teams panicking to 5-9 starts, thinking, man, maybe we're not going to make the playoffs. Where I feel like in the back of Houston's mind, the back of the Dodgers' mind, Yankees' mind, whatever it is, that they already know that they're going to be in that tournament.
I don't know. I'm starting to think that I bet the Astros are panicking right now. I mean, with the possibility that Verlander won't be back, I think they're panicking right now. I think they've got Greinke and then a lot of young, inconsistent starters behind them. And I know the lineup on paper is really good. Like cheating jokes aside, but I think they kind of are panicking. I'm a Blue Jays fan, so I'm enjoying the expanded playoffs because my favorite teams, whatever they are right now, 5-8 or something like that. But they're, you know, if there was regular playoffs, I would already be almost out on the Blue Jays season. It would just be like evaluate their young players, get some pleasure in that. But now with the expanded playoffs, I'm like, hey, they got a couple games coming up against the Marlins. Maybe they can grab those, get to 7-8. You know, I'm kind of aiming for 30-30 and see if that gets you in the playoffs. But I've moved the Astros in my mind. I think the Twins are a playoff lock, the Yankees. I think the Rays probably are and the A's are. Beyond them, I've moved the Astros out of my playoff lock status. even the Indians, I was really into going into the season. And I still am because they pitch so well, and I think they'll be in there. But man, they haven't hit. And, you know, I don't know. It's like you're a good week away from pulling away, but you're also, if you're with the Astros right now, like you're one bad week away from like kind of burying yourself. Like what are the Astros, something like 6-9? One bad week and all of a sudden you're like 8-13, and that's a hole to climb out of in less than 40 games.
It's just from it's a chaotic season. Let's steer into it. Maybe it would be fun if the Marlins could somehow make the playoffs and yeah. the Astros didn't. I just think that would be something fun we could steer into. I'm generally not too proud when it comes to save chasing, where if somebody's got the role and it seems like, you know, if somebody has been pushed into a save situation back-to-back days, they convert. I think most managers, even the ones that say they want a committee, maybe Tampa Bay's always going to have a committee. I'm fine with that. But when I see most managers go to a guy in the ninth inning back-to-back games or at the end of a game, they get a save from somebody, they usually think, okay, this is working out. I'm going to ride this until it doesn't work out. When I saw Trevor Rosenthal start to get save chances in Kansas City, I just thought, man, he's been too mediocre of a pitcher lately. I don't want to dance with this. Kennedy, I had a good run with last year. When Holland get a couple of early save chances, I kind of ignored it. Rosenthal got put into that situation. I'm like, I've danced this dance. It didn't end well. And well, now I see him with a couple more saves. He's got 10 strikeouts in 7 innings, 3 saves, a whip around 0.60. And he's been actively added in Yahoo over the last day or so, 25% added roster percentage. He's still available in about 2/3 of leagues, not in the leagues that I play in. Did I just snooze and lose on Rosenthal? Should I just, you know, we talk about, again, going back to Ron Chandler, he said for years, draft skills, not roles. And the one place I think it's a little bit different is with the saves, where if a guy has the baton, sometimes they don't need to be all that great. As long as they're not gasoline alley, they're going to have value for us. I wonder if I blew it with Trevor Rosenthal. What do you see happening there?
Yeah, I could see him being a really good August source who gets traded at the end of August. I think that's quite possible, right? I think the Royals could look to move him. They could look to move Holland. They could look to move Kennedy. I think it's going to be a seller's market at the deadline because the expanded postseason, that's going to put us in a situation where there are very few teams who are bowing out at the end of August, and the Royals could be one of them. You know, instead of half the league thinking that they don't have a chance to make it, I think a lot of teams might try to hang on because once you're in, you just never know. Especially with the big boys having to play in the first round, like we're not even giving out buys this year to the Yankees or someone, so you just never know. But yeah, I think with Rosenthal, they really started to use Holland, you know, not as the closer quite quickly. I do have some Rosenthal in a league or two. And I'm not counting on him for the 2 months, but I am kind of counting on him now for August. I think you're right with what Ron says with draft skills, you know, over role, I think is a good plan with hitters and a good plan with maybe a starting pitcher who doesn't have a rotation spot, but there's 5 ways into every rotation and draft the skills and just wait for one of those 5 ways to open up for him. With the relievers, the thing with drafting skills, not roles, it's not just the closer role thing. It's that reliever skills all over the place from 1 year to the next. Like these are the most inconsistent players in baseball. They throw 60 innings a year. They throw as hard as they can. 1 year a reliever is dynamite. The next year he can't find the strike zone or his velocity's down or he just completely, or he gets hurt and he just completely disappears and we never hear from him again. You know, if I said draft skills, not roles, well, like what are Edwin Diaz's skills? Like what are they? Are they the skills he showed the last year in Seattle? Are they the skills he's shown since he's been on the Mets? Like, and the line is so fine. Edwin Diaz, when he's going good, has just enough control to be a dominant closer like he was a couple years ago with Seattle. When the skills aren't going so great, he doesn't have enough control, you know, to overcome, you know, to let his strikeout rate shine through. So it's hard to even just figure out I'll be honest, I don't even know what Trevor Rosenthal is anymore. He's been good in his career. He's been bad in his career. He's been hurt in his career. He's trying to resurrect his career. We see pitchers all the time resurrect their careers. I don't even know what the skills are. I just know that he's the guy at the back end of their bullpen. So here we go. I'll drop him if he blows a couple saves. Because so will the Royals.
I think that's a great way of analyzing it. You know, I know this isn't a direct correlation, but I think about like goalies in hockey. I'm never surprised when a good goalie plays really poorly for an extended period of time And I'm never surprised when a goalie I knew nothing about, a minor league goalie, comes out of nowhere and stands on his head. And, you know, Tim Thomas, you know, did that and led the Bruins to a Stanley Cup. And you see the hockey teams manage this way, where if their starting goalie goes bad for a few games and somebody else gets hot, they'll ride the hot hand. In the case of pitching, it can be a new catcher. It can be a new pitching coach. It can be a new spot on the rubber. Maybe they were pitching from the full windup and they're taking a stop in the middle. Maybe they've gone the other way on that. Maybe they've scrapped a pitch. Maybe they've added a pitch. Maybe they talked to a new teammate and he said, no, hold your slider this way. It can be so many different things. And I think we have to be open-minded just to the volatility of them. That volatility is especially high in the bullpen. As you said, you know, Diaz, not that long ago, Diaz, Trinan, Kimbrel, these were names we trusted, you know, and then when things go bad, I think you need to be proactive about, you know, who's not pitching well and maybe who stepped into that void. It seems like finally Liam Hendricks is going to be a back-to-back Oakland closer who's lasted, because it seems like every year they've turned over their closer situation, but maybe this year they're going to have some stability. But I think you're right that pitching is so unusual. It's kind of an unnatural act anyway, and there's so many moving parts to it that we need to be open-minded to the different reasons why pitchers can go good or go bad. And we, a lot of times the explanation is going to trail. We're not going to know until much down the road. And we know certain things to look for, velocity dips and stuff like that. We have a lot more measurable stats than we've ever had before, but let's just be open-minded that you think you got pitchers good. Well, you know, maybe he's good today. We'll see how he is a couple weeks from now. Talking to our man, Fred Zinke, on the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball podcast. We're going to go to our draft. We're going to have a full fun today with, I thought, let's just draft curveballs. Let's just draft pitchers who throw really cool curveballs, guys that we think about and remember. And as I made my list, which isn't particularly deep, I realized this is one week I need to cheat. I need to go first. I can't have Zinke running this draft. So I'm going to draft first. We'll love the draft. You know, anybody you want, if you want to draft Cy Young, as far as I'm concerned, that's fine. I'm going to draft Clayton Kershaw first. And I've always loved his curveball. I've always loved watching him pitch. And I will always consider, I'll always link together the prime of his career with Vin Scully. It would be a late night game. I'd be looking to relax before I went to bed. I'd pop on the Dodger game if, God forbid, I was lucky enough to see the Dodgers, because I know a lot of people couldn't do that at some point. But I'd watch Kershaw. I'd listen to Scully, and that to me was like a baseball lullaby. Yeah, Dodger Stadium is a beautiful backdrop to watch a game. So in the curveball draft, start me off with Kershaw.
That's a great one. I think forever in my life, I'll think that Clayton Kershaw's back is just one of the most disappointing things in sports. You know, like if that back didn't give out on him a couple years ago, I just don't even know what Clayton Kershaw could have looked like throughout his career, right? Like he was so dominant. You know, if he had been able to stay healthy, like I think that ship sailed. Maybe it'll come back. I don't know, but I think it sailed. I just would have loved to have seen Kershaw as a 200 inning pitcher all the way to age, like Justin Verlander is, except he would have been so much better. He would have been Verlander, but better. Because he
was Kershaw so already, anyways, is he already a Hall of Famer in your mind?
So I think that Kershaw, I thought about this. I think he's a Hall of Famer as long as his career just continues. Like it can continue in an injury plagued way, but he's good still, but he's just not the 200 inning guy. Like if he could just be the 175 inning guy for 5 or 6 more years, then I think he's a Hall of Famer. If he just never threw another pitch, I don't know if he is. It's just so hard to get in the baseball hall. Now yeah. I don't know if he is, but I mean,
I like peak over longevity. Yeah. I would always rather see the Pedro. I mean, Pedro Martinez was a Hall of Famer anyway, but like I'd rather see, say, Johan Santana in the Hall of Fame and maybe Tony Perez not, something like that. I think if you're if you're electric for a few years, and by the way, I thought Santana really had a case to be debated, and he was off the ballot so quickly. But anyway, that's
you know, Kershaw is the
maybe we'll drop some Hall of Fame stuff down the road.
Yeah, and I mean Kershaw is, I think, the best pitcher of his generation. So I guess he should be a Hall of Famer, you know. And he did do really well up until, you know, almost 30. Anyways, I'll make my first round pick. I'm gonna go back a little further and take Doc Gooden. Gooden had a great curveball, and I just think early career, I know there were a lot of ups and downs off the field and that impacted on the field of Doc Gooden's career, but the early career Doc Gooden with the Mets is just about as fun. You know, we've talked about this, I think at one point during the shutdown, we were doing some of those retro drafts and things, but 86 Mets are like that. I'm about 9 years old in 86. Like, that's like when I'm really getting into baseball. Doc Gooden was so fun. That Mets team was so fun during that time. They were one of my favorite teams in the league at that time. So I'm going to take him. He's someone who have a great curveball. I was not old enough to appreciate the curveball, but I know he had a great curveball, and I know he's one of my favorite pitchers to watch. Just really enthusiastic, and the crowd would get going, and it was so special early in his career.
Well, I'm a Red Sox fan, so you just basically knifed me in the heart with the 86 mention. Gooden was high up on my list. I remember the joke they used to tell is that most pitcher, they have Uncle Charlie as their curveball, but with Gooden, it was such a good curveball, they called it Lord Charles. I've always rooted for Gooden. He did a Yahoo Fantasy Football event with us a couple of years ago. He's like a Mets ambassador. Could not have been a nicer guy. I know he's had some issues off the field, this personal life. And I just remember just meeting him, gentle dude, really nice person. And I've always rooted for him just to enjoy the rest of his life and to settle into a good place in life. I just think he's a good heart in Dwight Gooden. And he certainly, man, did he have a devastating curveball. Well, if you're going to promote the Mets, I have to attack this back. You know, I'm hurt now. And so I have to hurt Met fans. I'm sorry, Met fans. You might not want to listen to this. I'm going to take Adam Wainwright, who threw, if you were to ask me who threw the most famous curveball that I can remember, that I can play out in my head, it's that Wainwright curveball they threw to Carlos Beltran to close out the NLCS. I don't even remember exactly what year it was. It was sometime in the 2000s. Just a knee buckler. One of those things where Beltran knew he was out as soon as the pitch hit the mitt. It was just that great of a curveball. And I always loved Wainwright because his fastball was always let's try to sneak it in there. Let's try to get in the head in the count and then throw the pitches I really want to throw. He shows that you can be a star without maybe an elite fastball. Not that he had a bad fastball, but I mean, he never really had that elite fastball. And he's also the answer to one of my favorite trivia questions. He has the most career Cy Young shares in voting without ever actually winning the award. So I think that's a pretty cool stat. I know Wainwright is a big fantasy football guy and has done a lot with charity and fantasy football. So I feel like there's a good heart there. And man, what a hook he threw to Carlos Beltran. I've always been in Wainwright's corner.
Yeah, that's a really good one. He's someone he was one of the first people I thought of when we started this topic, when I thought of curveballs. Now I'm going to go with a local guy and I'm going to take Roy Halladay. I could have taken Roy Halladay for a lot of different pitches if you had asked me about them, but I'm going to talk about a little bit about his curveball, like just great memories of watching him, mostly with the Blue Jays for me, but also with the Phillies. But he was someone who had just such a great mix of his fastball and his curveball, seemed to know just when to use both of them. And I also thought of Halladay quickly, not just because he was so good, because he had a great curveball, but because that's just such a legendary story of him going to the majors and then all the way back down to A-ball and then rebuilding himself and then coming back up and having a Hall of Fame level career. So when I think about, you know, Halladay and what pitches he throws, I always picture him, you know, back in those, all the way back in single A, you know, tail between his legs, trying to get that curveball down, trying to, you know, locate his fastball, all those things. And he did it. So I think he's an inspiring story for young athletes who hit bumps in the road, that the bumps don't get much bigger than what Halladay faced, and he managed to overcome them and then play at such a high level for so long.
Man, so many great things about Doc Halladay, the no-hitter in the playoffs, and mm-hmm. You know, obviously a Hall of Famer, a life gone too soon. I remember the year where he went to Philadelphia, and you know back in the old days, Fred, when we had a DH in one league and not in the other, mm-hmm. and I said to myself, Doc Halladay in the National League, I'm going to draft this guy in the first round next year. Man, this guy is going to chew up and spit out the National League. And what a fun Philadelphia mm-hmm. staff you had with him and Hamels and Cliff Lee, who I always enjoyed mm-hmm. watching pitch. And big Doc Halladay fan. Rest in peace. One of my favorite guys to watch. Again, because I'm getting reflexive. You triggered me with the 1986 Red Sox. I'm going to take Bruce Hurst mm-hmm. and remind people that Hurst was actually named the MVP late in Game 6 of 1986. And then, of course, the game went kind of haywire, and they scrapped all that. And they took all the champagne wrapping out of the Red Sox. Bob Costas still tells the story of how quickly they cleaned out the Boston Red Sox locker room because they weren't going to be celebrating anything that night. The thing I loved about Hurst is that we think of the great curveball, and usually it's that 12-6 curveball, which it was, of course, very eye appealing. Hurst threw the sweeping curveball. He threw the curveball that was aimed at the batter's, like, you know, head or, you know, his shoulders, and then it would land in the strike zone. And it was just so pretty to watch. And if you watched him pitch a lot with two strikes, you knew it was coming, and it would just freeze the hitter so often, which is one of the great things about a curveball, is when the batter can't get the bat off his shoulders, but then he immediately knows that he's out when the pitch is caught. So growing up in New England, Hurst was one of my favorite guys to pitch. And again, he had that sweeper. It wasn't the 12-6 curve. It was the sweeping curve. And, you know, if the 10th inning had gone differently, you know, Bruce Hurst would have a World Series MVP in his mantle. And instead, all he is just somebody I remember fondly from my days growing up.
I like that one. I had some good Bruce Hurst baseball cards when I was a kid. I don't know. He had his good baseball card pictures, not pitchers, on them. For my next pick, I'm going to go with someone more modern. Pitcher Ninja is so popular right now, and, you know, being able to watch pitches, you know, from his Twitter feed. I'm going to take Aaron Nola. Some of the best curveballs you'll see on his feed are the Aaron Nola curveballs. And I have no shares of Nola this year. I had some concerns about him beyond the curveball that just caused me, and he was also late coming in for some of my later drafts. He was late coming in July. I have no Nola this year, but just from a pure one pitch standpoint, some of the prettiest pitcher ninja, videos that you'll see on Twitter are Aaron Nola and his curveball.
Yeah, that really hurts me because I've been a big Nola fan, and I talked about Wainwright earlier, and the pitcher who Wainwright reminds me of, Nola reminds me of is Wainwright. Mm-hmm. I don't think Nola has a great fastball, but he works off it really well. He had double strikeout game earlier this year. You just don't see a lot of those in 2020. He's one of my favorite guys to watch pitch. He works quickly. I like the backdrop of the Philadelphia ballpark. And one of my favorites, and certainly was going to be one of my next picks. So you sniped me on that one. Let's stay current. Charlie Morton's been a favorite of mine. Great curveball. I like the shape of his career. I always think it's fascinating when guys figure it out in the second halves of their careers. And some people would say, oh, well, big deal. He figured it out in Houston. What's the special sauce there? Are they even doing everything legal? Well, he's been pretty darn good with Tampa Bay, too. It used to be, it's funny how many pitchers have left Pittsburgh and changed the way they pitch. I mean, in Pittsburgh, he was ground chuck. He was getting the ground balls. He's become much more of a wipe them out guy with Houston and with Tampa Bay. But Charlie Morton's become one of my favorites over the last few years, and much respect for what he's done in the second half of his career.
Yeah, and just landed on the IL today, which is a little troubling for a lot of us in fantasy, I think myself.
Don't try to sway the voters. Don't try to sway the voters by bringing up facts, Fred. I don't appreciate that.
My next pick is Roy Oswalt. Had a great curveball. I'm not a big Marcus Stroman guy, even though he pitched in Toronto and is undersized. I typically root for undersized starting pitchers. I just think it's kind of cool. We know that there's advantages to being a taller pitcher, especially, and I think a taller starting pitcher. Like I am in awe of what Randy Johnson can do. I get all that. But Roy Oswalt was undersized. He came into the league just kind of, in the middle / maybe moving towards the end of the steroid era, right? I think it was 2001 was his rookie year. There was a lot of offense there. I just really appreciated Roy Oswalt. I felt like he's a really underrated pitcher who is consistent. I think it was because I was playing I still am, but I was playing a ton of fantasy baseball in the early 2000s. And, I felt like he was underrated. We talked about Pedro. We talked about Randy Johnson. Roy Oswalt wasn't as good as them, but he's a really good pitcher, on some pretty fun Houston teams. Had a great curveball, and I just really appreciate guys. Like I said, I've never been a big Marcus Stroman guy because I just find he draws a lot of attention to himself, and because sometimes I think he speaks before he thinks and everything. But in general, I like the undersized starter who's able to hang around in the league for a really long time at a really high level, and Oswalt to me is one of those guys.
Yeah, great pick. It's funny, I didn't remember his name when I was recounting how great that Philly staff was, but he was a part of that team as well, and was on some really good Houston teams also, and I was a big fan of his. Well, you want to go undersized pitcher? I can match you for that. I'm going to go with Tom Gordon, who know better now as D. Gordon's father. And there's a lot of cool stuff with Gordon. He came up, he almost won Rookie of the Year when he was a starter with the Royals. He came up really young. He was 21 in his rookie season. And then later he became a reliever, and he had a 46 save season with the Red Sox. In fact, I think Stephen King wrote a book called The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. That's how central he was to the New England backdrop at the point. And talk about a 12-6er. He had maybe the best curveball I've ever seen. And this is a guy who's like all of 5'9". It didn't always go good with Gordon. I mean, he had some bad seasons, some seasons where his ERA was over 5. And then, like a lot of players, he just bounced around. He played for 8 different teams, primarily with the Royals and Red Sox. But I mean, I'm just looking at his baseball reference page. I don't remember him on the White Sox or the Astros or the Diamondbacks or the Yankees, but on a lot of different teams. But when he was going good, man, his 12-6er was an absolute thing of beauty.
Yeah, he was another. There's another one from my childhood. I thought Flash Gordon was so fun.
Flash Gordon,
just great. Like just a lot of, like when he was in the game, it was exciting. That's my memory of him. Just exciting when he's in the game. For my next pick, I'm going to take Satchel Paige. I'll work Satchel Paige into basically any baseball conversation where it's possible. He's known for having an outstanding curveball, and I truly believe, I always will, that if the major leagues had been open to black players, 15 years sooner than they were, that we would be talking about Satchel Paige as, one of, if not the best major league pitcher of all time. I really think he could have done that. What he did coming in with the Indians as a rookie at age 43, I think it was, is absolutely remarkable. I mean, just think about that as a 43-year-old rookie coming in and being dominant. I mean, I know he'd been pitching already, right? But he doesn't come from the minors. But anyways, if Satchel Paige had been able to pitch in the majors during his 20s and his 30s, I think we would talk about him like we talk about every great pitcher. I know he does get a lot of respect, but I think he would get even more. And his curveball, although I'm not seeing any pitcher ninja videos of his curveball, but from what everyone says, it was legendary.
It's a great pick. It's always been on my bucket list to get to Kansas City, Missouri, where there's the Negro Leagues mm-hmm. Baseball Museum. I know Joe Posnanski talks about that a lot. He was really good friends with Buck O'Neill. And I just feel like there's a lot. I know a fair amount of that history, but there's so much I don't know. And for every Satchel Paige or Cool Papa Bell, who I may know pretty well, there's a lot of players who I hardly know at all. And it would just be really cool to go through some of that video, some of those artifacts. I think it's always cool when they bring back the Negro League uniforms a few times a year. I just think the really cool part of baseball history. And I think there's never been a better time, I think, to be more schooled in where some of this stuff came from. And hopefully there's more social progress along the way with the way things have been in this country, because I mean, it's just mind blowing to think, mm-hmm. Babe Ruth never had to face black pitching. It just doesn't seem right that the world was wired that way, but we're trying to take steps forward. Satchel Paige, a great legacy pick to end our curveball draft. We've been talking to Fred Zinke today, my friend, and just one of the best fantasy players and analysts out there. And he's been doing a lot of work for us for Yahoo this year. So you can read Zinke 3 or 4 times a week on Yahoo. We feel very lucky for that. Fred, give everybody your social handles and what you're working on this week.
Yeah. So you can find me on Twitter at Fred Zinke MLB. I always try to be quick to answer, lineup or trade questions, and help people through their seasons. Those are obviously even more urgent decisions this year. And as you said, I'm actually pretty honored. I'm great. It's glad you brought up. I always associate the term closing time with you, Scott. I know Dalton writes it too, but I don't know why I've always associated with you. I actually, when I sent the first one in, I didn't call it closing time. And then Jason, our editor wrote me back and said, no, it's okay. You can call it closing time. I said, I don't feel right calling. That's Scott's. I can't do that. And he's like, no, it's not just Scott's. You can do it. So I feel honored to be a part of the closing time crew right now. And I'm doing some waiver wire articles because like you said, you cannot wait on the waiver wire this year. The player will not be there in very long. And you need the games now. If Trevor Rosenthal's getting saves, get them now before they dry up.
Totally agree. I wait for proof, I think, has never been a deader strategy mm-hmm. than it is right now. And, I'll take availability over ability in so many cases. I was joking with Frank Schrog, my colleague. We need to make a drop on a team we co-own together on the weekend. And he's like, well, who can we drop? And I said, I think I have – there's 4 guys on this team that I have any, I feel like I owe them anything. I have any loyalty to. I'll drop like almost anybody else on our roster. That's just kind of the way things go in 2020. Thank you, everybody, for spending some time with us today on the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. Fred was great, As usual, mad props to Raghu, our producer, keeping us on the air and sounding good. If you like sports podcasts, I want you to know that the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast is now running 5 days a week. That's going to be not just an August thing, but we're going to do that in season. We have a lot of exciting things planned for that. So if you're a fantasy football player, you'll want to check that out. I did the quarterback preview with TJ Hernandez on Sunday. We're doing a bunch of positional previews this week. So I know a lot of you people are also listening to baseball or also fantasy football players. Check that out. We get a whole suite of fantasy and sports podcasts on Yahoo. We have college podcasts, football podcasts. So there's something for everybody. Check that out. Again, for Fred, for Raghu, I'm Scott. We'll be back next week with a baseball conversation. Let's stay safe. Let's keep those active rosters fluid. Get to the waiver wire. Maybe even pick up Trevor Rosenthal. We'll pick this up next week.
I'm Michael Isikoff, Chief Investigative Correspondent for Yahoo News.
And I'm Dan Kleidman, Editor-in-Chief of Yahoo News.
We're the hosts of Skullduggery, where our current focus is on the president and his administration's handling of the coronavirus, as well as the 2020 elections. Subscribe and download Skullduggery wherever you listen to your podcasts.